Good morning, everybody. My name is Janice Fallucci. I am a civil rights attorney in the state of California. I'm also executive director of the Alliance Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. This is our monthly meeting that we have to discuss the law, just to discuss regulations, to discuss pending lawsuits, etc. If you don't want to be part of this meeting, this is a good time for you to say goodbye. And if in fact you might be a troll, we will you'll be leaving the meeting. Also, if there's anything inappropriate that should show up on the screen, you will be blocked. So please don't do that either. Okay, so sometimes I feel like a mom or a grandmother that I am. Alrighty, so let's go ahead and get started because we are going to have a slightly different kind of meeting today. And I'm really excited about that. The kind of meeting that we're going to have today, we'll go over some of the topics that we normally go over. But in addition to that, we have invited the Florida two representatives from the Florida Action Committee, at least two, to come join us. And you might wonder, well, wait a minute, California is on one side of the country and Florida is on the other side of the country. What? Why are you even talking to each other? Well, guess what? The two states have a lot of issues in common with people who are on the registry as well as their family members. So we thought, it's a good time to start talking to each other. And so what we're doing right now is talk and exploring. So they two, well, at least two members of Florida Action Committee came to California in October when we had our conference, our annual conference at in Los Angeles. And then Florida Action Committee invited myself and our board president, Carpenter, to join a couple of their meetings recently. And so that happened as well. And what we're trying to do, quite frankly, is to forge a bond between the two states. So we'll see what that actually looks like in the future, but I know one of the things that we're contemplating, and we'll certainly be thinking about it later, is in fact the possibility that Axol and will in fact pursue litigation in the state of Florida. I say that with great trepidation. Florida has a terrible reputation when it comes to litigation for, on behalf of registrants, and part of it is like, how steep a mountain do we want to climb? Having said that, we have filed recently lawsuits in the state of Missouri and in the state of Arkansas. So we're now beyond our border, the borders of California. And for those of you who live in California, just understand we're not giving up on California. In fact, this is the only state where I am licensed to practice law. Having said that, the great thing about about federal district courts is I can appear in the Latin term is pro hoc vice, which is just like as a visitor, okay, as long as I have a local counsel who I'm joining with. So I have local counsel and Florida, not Florida yet, though I have been talking to somebody about that possibility. And but I do have local counsel in Missouri and in Arkansas. So the Missouri and Arkansas cases are similar in that in both states, what we're doing is we're challenging the Halloween sign requirements. So in those two states right now, they are requiring people on the registry, as far as I understand, all people on the registry to post a sign on their home. That there are some pretty big differences between the two states. Like in Missouri, there's a state law and it says every registrant and it says on the day of Halloween. Missouri, I'm sorry, Arkansas by comparison is much broader and that Arkansas says it's a county law, it's not a state law, and they're saying for 2 weeks. So the week before Halloween, on the day of Halloween, and the week after. Both of these, we believe, are subject to successful lawsuits. At least we hope so. And so it has to do with the First Amendment. And so most of us, when we think about the First Amendment, we think about the fact that we have the freedom to speak. But the First Amendment also has the freedom not to speak. And so when the government makes you say something, like a sign on the front door of your home, that is called compelled speech. And we've been successful challenging that here in California. We've gotten rid of all those Halloween sign requirements in the state of California. And then there are a couple of other states where they've challenged and they've also been successful, the lawsuits in those states as well. So we're building upon that. And quite frankly, the ultimate goal that Axol has is to get rid of Halloween sign requirements in the entire nation. So if in fact you know of another state, or maybe it's a county, where there are Halloween sign requirements, please let us know, and we will sue them when we have the resources to do so. Okay, so that's a long introduction. But again, I know we've got some other people here who have just joined the group. And I see, yeah, I see we have about 50 people so far, and we're expecting a few more. So, oh, there's board member Ellie Miller. Welcome, Ellie. Hi. Thank you for being here today.
Good morning.
Great. So, Eleanor Miller is a law professor, also in Los Angeles. She's at Loyola Law School, and she is a member of our Axel Board of Directors. So, Ellie, is there anything you want to say this morning as we get ready to start?
No, just that I direct a post-conviction clinic, and we serve low-income and no-income individuals, and we also help people get off the registry, and our
Fabulous.
services are free.
Yeah. So if you all are interested, and Ellie, would you mind putting your contact information over there in the chat room?
Okay.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much. And Ellie, were you on when I said that we're going to have Florida join us today?
No, I wasn't. I just logged on about a minute. You were talking about the Halloween signs.
Yeah. Okay. I just noticed that you were there, so I didn't know how long you had been on there. Okay. So when I was doing that preamble, talking about, exploring ways that California and Florida can cooperate with one another, the fact is today, as part of this meeting, we have in fact invited Florida to join us. So I know Chris is here, and I believe Danelle is here, both from Florida. And I'm going to do a little more preamble here, and then I'm going to ask Danelle, our Florida counterparts, to speak and to share with you what is going on in their fair state. So in each and every meeting that we have, the monthly meetings, we talk about two things. One of the things that we talk about, quite frankly, is scam. Okay. So unfortunately, there are people out there who prey upon people who are required to register. And that is so sad and disgusting. But I bring it up because I want you to be prepared for if and when you get a phone call from one of the scammers. Okay. So the scammers, my understanding, they call up, they pretend that they're law enforcement. They say, I'm Sergeant so and so, detective, blah, blah, blah. And oh, by the way, you need to come, there's a problem with your DNA sample. A lot of times these days, it has to do with your DNA and it's been destroyed, it's been damaged. We never got in the first place, all of which is a lie, by the way. And there's a warrant for your arrest. That's a bigger lie. Okay, the biggest lie. So folks, if there's a warrant out for your arrest, the police are not going to call you ahead of time so you can bake them cookies. They're just going to come and arrest you. Okay, so please understand that is just one sign that this is a scam. I said there's a warrant out for your arrest, but I'm being so kind today that I'm letting you know ahead of time that in fact that, there's a warrant for your arrest. And guess what? We can make the problem go away if you only pay us X number of dollars. Now that's a huge tip off, right? If anybody demands money from you, I don't care if they say the chief of police, don't believe them. Okay. They're not. And the thing is, they're just going to take your money and run away with it. And by the way, I'm a good attorney, maybe I'm even better than good, but I cannot get your money back if you give it to a scammer. It's gone. Okay. Because they turn into cryptocurrency or Bitcoin or whatever the latest method of payment, I guess, or gift cards. They want you to go get a gift card. But guess what? The solution when a scammer calls you is really, really easy and simple. You know what it is? Just hang up. Just hang up the phone. You don't have to talk to them. And by the way, that's the one thing that they say, do not hang up, right? Do not hang up, or that police car will be, the police cruiser will be there any minute to pick you up. Just hang up. Okay. The minute somebody tells me, don't hang up, I'm hanging up, and I recommend that you do the same. Okay, so we talk about that every month. Another thing that we talk about on a monthly basis has to do with compliance checks. So at least in the state of California, the police from time to time decide they have nothing better to do than knock on your door. Okay, now one of the reasons that groups of law enforcement do this is they grant money. They get paid often by the state government, the federal government, county government, or some combination thereof. They're getting paid overtime to dress up in their SWAT uniforms. Sometimes they're dressed up in SWAT uniforms, and to come knock on work. I mean, it's totally ridiculous. I don't think their heart's in it, but their pocketbook is in it, right? Their wallet's in it because they're getting paid over. So if somebody comes to your house for a a compliance check and you're not on parole and you're not on probation, you do not have to let them in house. In fact, my recommendation, a strong recommendation, is do not let them even look inside of your house. So if they knock on the door, and again, you're not on parole or probation, go bake some cookies. You can tell I bake cookies a lot. Go clean the bathtub, whatever you want to do, which is not answer the door. There's no obligation for you to answer the door. If they're really a compliance check, they're going to leave a piece of paper behind, maybe a business card behind that says, please call us, and you can do that at your leisure. Whenever it's convenient for you, call the phone number that they leave you. Okay. But otherwise, you don't want them to look into your house because they might see something that they consider to be suspicious. Okay. Now, I know way back in the dark ages when marijuana, even small amounts, were not legal, somebody could see like rolling papers for cigarettes. Some people actually roll their own cigarettes. Okay. And they thought, oh, I see papers. So that gives me probable cause to come rush in your house because illegal activity is going on. So we're just sharing this with you to tell you what you have to do and what you don't have to do. If you're on parole or probation, by the way, probably one of your conditions says that you're subject to search at any time. You got to let them in your house. Okay. Otherwise, that might constitute a violation and you could be returned to custody. So I'm talking about people who are not on parole and people who are not on probation. You do not have to answer the door. If you choose to, they answered the door. I strongly recommend the following. You walk outside your door. You close the door behind you because remember, you don't want the police looking into your house. They have the craziest thing. So this is applied to other states. Yes, it does apply to other states. Okay, because this is based upon the U.S. Constitution. The Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, correct me if I'm wrong, Ellie, the Fourth Amendment says you're protected against unreasonable searches. Okay, and it's unreasonable for the cops to come in your house if they don't have a warrant, you're not on parole, and you're not on probation. No, they don't get that. Unless there's some other exceptions, of course. Like if somebody comes running into your house with a gun, yeah, they can. If your house is burning down, yes, they can. There's always exceptions to the rule, but that's a general rule. So that rule, again, with compliance checks, does in fact apply to people in other states, not just California. And by the way, I have a handout here, and when I say here in my office, that talks and reminds people who are required to register that they too have constitutional rights. And there'll be plenty of people out there who want to tell you, you don't have constitutional rights. Well, please listen politely and then discard everything that they say. The Fourth Amendment and the entire U.S. Constitution does apply to. Okay, more people coming in. Okay, that's great. All right. So I'm going to ask Danelle and Chris to speak in just a minute. So somebody put in the chat room, they came to my house and demanded I produce the little receipt I get every year when I register and threatened to arrest me if I couldn't find it. I could not find any rule requiring me to keep or produce that receipt and has not mentioned my list of rules. Do I need that little receipt? If you're in California, the answer is no, you don't. You don't have to keep. In fact, there was a state law in California for a while that everybody who was on the registry had to keep this little piece of paper. It was about the size of a driver's license, but now in most states, they don't even put it out anymore. They don't give it to most people. Okay, so Ellie, are you disagreeing with me? Do you have a different
I'm
opinion?
agree with you. I'm just saying don't they shouldn't give consent either. They're
Yeah.
not on probation or parole. Do not give consent to search.
Thank you. And folks, I mean, I have a client before he was my client who allowed the police, they knocked on his door. They go, hi, we're the police. We're here to help. Right? You heard that one before, right? And then the next thing they said, oh, can we come in your house? And he's like, yeah, sure. I have nothing to hide. So they came into his house. While they're in his house, they noticed that he had a computer. And they said, oh, you have a computer. How nice. You mind if we look on your computer? And he's like, I don't have anything to hide. Go right ahead. I was horrified. Folks, if that ever happens to you, first, don't let them in your house. But second, do not let them on your computer. I mean, if nothing else, they could plant something on your computer. Okay. And these days of child pornography and all the severe consequences for possessing child pornography, you do not want to let the police using your computer at all unless they have a search warrant. Again, unless you're on probation or unless you're on parole. You want to add anything to that, Ellie?
No, that sums it up. But if a person consents to the search, then police go into the house, and if they see something in plain view, they seize it, and it's a problem, like Janice said.
Police folks, Ellie and I and other attorneys, we're here to help you avoid some of the landmines that exist. I'm sorry that they do exist, but if we tell them, if we identify them for you, then in fact, you have a greater chance to avoid them. So there's a really important word word that Ellie just used. That word is consent. Okay. So when the police say, can we come into your house? If you say yes, that's consent. Okay. So that doesn't have to be in writing. If they ask you, oh, I see you have a computer. Can I go look on your computer? And you say, yes, that's consent. Remember, the Constitution applies to you and you can say no. Okay. Moving on. Sorry, Danelle. And sorry, Chris. I really do want you to speak. So are you there?
I'm here.
Yay, Danelle. Excellent. And how about you, Chris?
I'm here.
Excellent. Okay. So I don't know between the two of you who's going to lead off, but I just want to say both Chris and Danelle came to the Axol conference in Los Angeles in October. And that was when I first met Danelle. Chris, you and I had met before. And so it was a way, you know, I mean, they went out of their way to travel across country to come to our conference. And we were able to, you know, presentations, after presentations, dinner, glass of wine or whatever, we got to know each other better. And that was a good way for us to get started here, exploring what our common areas of interest are. So having said that, take it away, Chris and Danelle.
Hey, so this is Danelle. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
First, I have to make a confession, Janice. So I'm a huge Janice Bellucci fangirl. And we did meet before Axol. I met you at the War Conference in Washington, D.C. in the previous March. Chris and I were demonstrating on the steps of the Supreme Court, and it was very exciting, but it was a brief meeting. But of course, you know, I never washed my hand again because I shook yours. Anyway, we got to know each other at Axol, and, My name is Danelle Puglisi-Knutson, and I'm the advocacy director. And Chris Sparks is the state director of the Florida Action Committee Board of Directors. We are both registered citizens as well as board members. And we were greatly encouraged and energized by our attending the Axol conference in October. It was an amazing experience for us. And we are really grateful for the invitation and opportunity to be a part of your call today. Like Janice shared earlier at the beginning, we're today announcing a partnership between Florida Action Committee and Axol, because Axol is many successful cases further along in the journey to defeat and fight against the registry than FAC is. We're joining forces so FAC can learn to employ the same successful strategies in Florida and collaborate on advocacy projects to build a foundation for future litigation. So we want to go where Axol has already paved the way in California. And as Axol and FAC are the two major state advocacy organizations for persons forced to register in the two largest states in the nation, we can make a very powerful impact in the advocacy to abolish the registry in our states and nationwide. We feel like this is a great partnership. And like Janice said, we're, you know, 3,000 miles separated, but it's our fight is your fight and your fight is our fight. And you've come a long way. And we very much admire that and are energized by your success and hope to make that part of the recipe for our success. So Chris, you wanted to add something to that, right?
Yeah. I mean, as Danelle said, Axol has had major, major accomplishments in the realm of trying to erode the registry from, you know, passing bills in the legislation to obviously your litigation moved through the state of California like wildfire. So that's one of the big things we've asked Axol to kind of collaborate with us, because we have these specific issues in Florida, like the cancer of presence and residency laws that Axol was very good at litigating to get rid of. And it's spreading through our state like wildfire. You have counties where you can't literally be within 2,500 feet of a park or a library. You can't travel through it. It's basically banishment zone. We have some counties in Florida that if you're homeless, you can't even live there. It's illegal to live in a county if you're transient. So I'm actually really excited at, you know, getting to meet Janice and Catherine and a lot of Axol out there in California, because we're all in this together. We might be 3,000 miles away, like everyone says, but if we're required to register, we're all in the same boat. We're all part of the same family. And I truly believe by everybody working together on future projects and litigation that we can empower everybody to show up, stand up, and speak up.
Yes. Yes. And I don't want to leave Catherine out. not of the Love Fest either. So I did meet her for the first time at Axol in October, and I am now a Catherine fangirl as well.
Thank you, Danelle. It's good to have fans. Danelle, I know in addition to working with the Florida Action Committee, you also have another group that I think is just amazing, and I'm so grateful to you for doing it. And I'm thinking about the group of people of women on the registry. What have you talked about that briefly?
Yes, so that group is called Shine and Shine Voices, and it's Sisters Healing and Justice networking for empowerment. Okay. And we are a group exclusively for women forced to register. We are there for each other. So we are advocating and supporting and encouraging each other. It's a unique experience to be a woman on the registry. And it's one that a lot of other people are very empathetic about, but don't exactly understand. And because we understand each other's circumstances, we can encourage and support each other in ways that really nobody else in our lives can, even those who love us the most. And then we are also, the Shine Voices element is that we are active in advocacy. So we are going out and speaking. Our very first opportunity will actually be as a special guest on the Florida Action Committee call, the member call, which is coming up March 7th, so Thursday at 8 p.m. And y'all are invited to join that. And then we will be speaking for Dr. Emily Horowitz's class at St. Francis College in Brooklyn, New York on March 20th and meeting with some other academics and heavy hitters in the advocacy game. And we're very excited about that. Actually, six of us will be presenting, and one of us will be bringing her almost adult daughter, and you may be familiar with her name. It's Shauna Baldwin, who will be, she's a part of Shine. It's a nationwide group, so it's not limited to just women registrants in Florida. We have people from Arizona, California, Virginia, and other states. And Shauna has done other presentations. She's the one who was in the Untouchables movie. And her daughter is now 17 and will be presenting with us. And her daughter is not a part of the group, but she is she works with us. She's developing a logo for us. And so she's going to come and speak to what it means to be a family member and have your mom on the registry. So we are also going to be speaking at NARSOL. So we're really starting to develop the advocacy element. And we have already really very much enjoyed the encouragement and support part of our group. It's an amazing experience. And one of our members actually just joined Chris on a television news program that aired on the 15th. And they were speaking up as persons forced to register regarding the registry here in Florida. And Chris and the member in our group, they did a fantastic job of humanizing and speaking out articulately, intelligently, and rationally about a topic that people so sensationalize and use for fear mongering, particularly in the media, but in this state. And they did an amazing job. So that's what Shine's about. And women forced to register that have completed their probation from any state in the nation are welcome to contact me about joining.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Danelle. And I hope that you will put contact information over in the chat, chat room of this meeting and that, so people can, in fact, find out more. I have represented women who are required to register, and I will say that they do have unique challenges that they face. So that's, and when I met Danelle, well, when I saw you again, Danelle, at the conference in October, I was just amazed that you're doing this work. And again, so that the women on the registry who comprise a very small percentage, I don't know what the percentage is. I would guess it's no more than 1 or 2%. But the fact is that they have some unique challenges. Okay, so Chris, want to give you another opportunity here to talk about anything that is of interest to Florida?
I just want to copy Danelle there. In Florida, we do have a lot of support groups. And I've come in on the early part of the call. There was a support call that you guys do. So Florida kind of mimics that with the Shine group for women. And I have a men's group called the Bright Men's Group, Shine Bright. I thought it was kind of cool. Probably had too much wine. And of course, Florida, we're just constantly researching to expose. Florida has such a pyramid of state laws, county laws, city laws, township laws. I mean, anywhere you go, no matter where you move, it can be different. So I just believe Florida here, we're just excited to continue to grow and build these partners and network and support each other. Because like I said before, we have three pillars like you guys, to legislate, litigate, and educate. And I love your saying, show up, stand up, speak up. Because if we can all do that together, maybe we can finally start to move that needle just a little bit further our way. We're getting presence in Florida in the media. Danelle was right. I just flew to Jacksonville and did a news interview where the media is going to play both sides, but I think we got a pretty fair shot at an article where we're able to expose the new bill that we're fighting right now, which is Senate Bill 1230 and House Bill 1235, which now allow them to stack charges for failure to register. So if I forget to register a car and I go to my registration office 14 times and they finally catch it, I get 14 charges because now I have admitted that I had another car or an internet identifier or whatever it happens to be. It's just going to, if this passes, you could potentially get more time for a failure to register than your actual original conviction. So yes, Florida's busy here trying to, just keep being in the bushes. So, and thank you, Janice, and, Axel for having us here.
Absolutely. So one of the things that Axel shared with Florida during a board meeting and then also at a meeting like this online was, in fact, how we started out. So for those of you who may not be as familiar with Axel as some of the regulars, shall I say, we started out, our board of directors, we really made an important decision, which was to find what we considered to be the lowest hanging fruit. Okay. And so, in other words, who was most vulnerable to a legal attack? It's another way to put it, okay? So we looked at those things, and we were always looking for constitutional issues, right? But we were careful in what constitutional issues that we focused upon. So, for example, ex post facto and making, challenge anything based on ex post facto, that is really a tall mountain to climb right now because of a U.S. Supreme Court decision. I won't go into that right now, but just trust me that it is. And so we were looking for something that was easier to challenge. And so we started out with presence restrictions, which is places that you can go visit or not. So Chris was mentioning just a short while ago the fact there's in Florida, there's some presence restrictions that say you cannot go within 2,500 feet of a whole bunch of places, right? So I don't know. We haven't mapped out any of those possibilities yet, but we had a situation maybe similar to that, though it was 300 feet. It wasn't 2,500 feet, but basically in the city of Lancaster, and yes, I will name them by name. In the city of Lancaster, their presence restrictions basically meant that if a person was required to register, they couldn't go to their downtown area at all. The entire downtown area was off limits. So guess what? we challenged the restrictions early, and we won. Let's put it that way. They settled the case. They got rid of their restrictions. And oh, by the way, they paid the organization a few dollars for that pleasure, our pleasure of suing them. So let's go ahead and let's talk about other things too, because I know a lot of you are on this call to hear about travel restrictions, or travel things you can do, not just the restrictions, to talk about the tiered registry law here in California and the like. So let's go ahead and talk about travel. And before I do that, though, this is like a cautionary tale. Somebody in the chat room said, how do I get off the registry in Florida? Well, you may or may not be successful getting off the registry in Florida. Unfortunately, a whole lot of people are on Florida's registry who do not live there. Some of them are dead, by the way, yet the Florida registry continues to grow. So I assume there's a financial advantage in there somewhere for Florida to have such a large registry. Not sure what it is, not sure that I care. But the thing is that Florida has a really terrible registry in that you do not have to live there to get stuck on the Florida registry. So if you really, there is one attorney in Florida of whom I'm aware who has gotten a few people off the Florida registry. And by the way, they're people who no longer live there. I don't know about people who live there, if he's ever gotten anybody off the registry, but people who have visited the state of Florida and basically been required to register there, you know, send me an email. I did put my email address in the chat room there. You can send me an email and let me know that you want the contact information for that attorney. I'm not going to put it in the chat room because I don't want him to be deluged with calls and with inquiries. Okay, so let's talk about travel domestically, and then I'll talk about travel overseas. Domestically, you just need to know that the laws in every state are different, okay? And I mean that. So in Rhode Island, it's my understanding that there's a 24-hour registration requirement, which means if you're in the state of Rhode Island for more than 24 hours, you must register there. Now, that's, you know, so I'll read your chats later. Anyway, so that's a really short period of time. That's a negative thing. The positive thing is Rhode Island's a really small state, right? You don't have to stay in Rhode Island overnight. You can stay in one of the adjoining states. So if Aunt Martha invites you over for Thanksgiving and you really want to go to Aunt Martha's house because the rest of the family's going to be there, well, go to Aunt Martha's house for Thanksgiving, but stay in a hotel that's in another state that has a much longer period of time before you're required to register, okay? A state, Florida and Nevada, are the same right now, which is, means if you can, I'm sorry, if you're in those states for more than 48 hours or longer, you're required to register. Think about that, 48 hours or longer. Now, maybe somebody wants to go to Las Vegas for less than 48 hours. Okay, you can do it without registering. But the fact is, if you are there for 48 hours or longer, you must register. And I understand that Nevada does not make it easy to register. So you may be there for half the day registering while you're in Nevada. Okay. And by the way, Las Vegas and Reno are in the same state, the state of Nevada. You cannot spend 47 hours in Reno and then spend 47 hours in Las Vegas, because you add those two together, it's more than 48. You're going to have to register. And the same thing about Florida. Florida is a very large state, north to south, like California is. Though the good thing about both of our states, they're very narrow when it comes east to west. So if you leave the state, you can go back into the state as long as there's a break in time. And different attorneys have different opinions about this, but my opinion about this is you need to spend the night overnight in another state before you go back, before the clock starts all over again. I've had people tell me, I went to Las Vegas for a week and nothing bad happened. I'm happy for you if nothing bad happens, if you're there for an entire week. But the fact is, something terrible could have happened. You could have ended up in custody because you failed to register. Do you really want to do that to yourself? Folks, life is full of risk, right? And there's a whole spectrum of risk. And so it's up to you to decide how much risk you want to assume. But quite frankly, is it worth spending time in custody because you didn't register? And then you go, oh, well, how will they know if I'm visiting Las Vegas for more than 48 hours? Well, we've all read reports about people getting shot in Las Vegas. People's cars, you know, have break down, or you have a car accident. You might have some kind of medical emergency and end up in an emergency room of a hospital. If any of those things happen, heaven forbid, then you too could be found to have overstayed your welcome in the state of Nevada, or Florida for that matter. So why are we telling you, you know, why am I telling you over and over again not to basically register in another state? It's because when it comes to the international Megan's Law, if you are on any state registry, then the provisions of the international Megan's Law might apply to you. Okay. And I'm going to talk about that shortly. But just be really careful and plan ahead. Okay. You can plan ahead. That I, from time to time, people call me and go, well, I'm planning a cross-country trip in my RV from, you know, from California to Florida. And I was like, okay, it's legal for you to do that if you're not on parole or probation, by the way. But my goodness, you need to plan ahead, right? You don't want to overstay your welcome. That's one way that I think of it, without triggering the requirement to register. All right. So we're here again to help you through the minefield that is out there, and through you you being triggered again to have to register in another state. Now, somebody has asked, do we have to deregister in the state of California? That answer is yes, but only if you're moving permanently out of the state of California. If you are going to leave California and you go visit Virginia, okay, have fun. Go enjoy Virginia. I'm going to go to Hawaii, the other direction, go to Hawaii. You do not have to tell your registration officer that you are going out of state for vacation. Again, unless you're on parole or unless you're on probation. So I hope that answered your question. There are other states, by the way, this is only in California. There are other states and SORNA compliant states. You do have to tell people ahead of time, your registration officer, that in fact you are leaving the state. Somebody else had, what are California's visiting laws? If you visit California for more than 5 business days, you may trigger the requirement to register. I said a very important word there, business days. Okay. So let's just say you come to California on a Friday. Friday doesn't count. Saturday, Sunday doesn't count either. So you could probably make it to the following Friday without having to register. But be very careful. And as I said, please plan ahead. You know, when I mentioned before about taking risks, you are the one who will bear the brunt of making a bad decision or just being ignorant of the law. I hope you've all heard that expression. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. So you need to think ahead, need to plan ahead, and then enjoy your trip. Okay. And so there's all kinds of information available. There's information available on the Axol website and the like. Okay. And thank you, Ellie, for answering other questions in the chat room. So let's talk about travel overseas, because travel overseas is even more challenging than traveling within the United States. Why am I saying that? Because there's a terrible law out there, and I do mean it's a terrible law. It's called the International Megan's Law, that basically says the following. If you have been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and you're required to register, the International Megan's Law applies to you. Okay, those two factors. Okay, please mute yourself if you're not speaking to the group, okay? So again, two things. You're a covered sex offender under the International Megan's Law if you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, number one. And number two, you're currently required to register in any state. This is why registering in Florida is so negative and to be avoided if possible. It's the same with New York State, by the way, too. If you register in those states even once, you're on their registry for a lifetime, with some very tiny exceptions. Okay, so we want you to not register in more than one state so that you don't get tripped up here in the International Megan's Law. So I use some terms that I want to define now. International Megan's Law is a federal law, and because it's a federal law, the age of consent is 18. Okay, so if you've been convicted of an offense that involved a victim under the age of 18, then this is going to apply to you. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a hands-on or violent offense. What I mean by that, biggest category is child pornography. So if you were convicted of an offense involving child pornography, and again, the definition of child is under the age of 18, we're not talking about 5-year-olds, it could be a 17-year-old, then the International Megan's Law applies to you too. It can apply to indecent exposure. All these things are considered offenses involving a minor, again, even though there was no physical contact. So let's go on to why the International Megan's Law is such a terrible law. If those two things apply, if you are, quote, a covered sex offender underneath the International Megan's Law, then the federal government declares that they have the right to add what they call a unique identifier to your passport. They call it a unique identifier. I call it a scarlet letter. And by the way, I challenge this law in federal district court here in California as soon as possible after it became effective. And you know what? I lost that case. There's all kinds of reasons why. But I will tell you, part of my argument was the following. There are only two countries in the history of our planet, two, that have ever put a unique identifier on the passports of their citizens. One of them was Nazi Germany. And if you were a Jew living in Germany at that time, they added a big red J to your passport. And that meant you're Jewish. Okay. The only other country that's ever done it in the history of the planet was Russia. And they did the same thing. I don't think it was a big red J. I haven't been able to get a photograph of it yet, but I do know that it did happen. And again, I basically asked the federal court, why do we want to join that club? Why do we want to do what Nazi Germany did? And why would we want to do what Russia did? In both cases, by the way, identifying people who were Jewish and saying, you know, adding the scarlet letter to their passport. So as I said, I was not successful in that lawsuit. But I'll tell you what, as a civil rights attorney, if I don't lose a case from time to time, I feel like I'm not pushing hard enough. I'm trying to push the envelope all the time. Okay. So anyway, it's happening. It's in effect. I'm still looking for my Rosa Parks plaintiff. I'm willing to go for another lawsuit here if I can find my perfect plaintiff. And my perfect plaintiff would be somebody who has an offense like possession of child pornography, somebody who, or a misdemeanor, would be misdemeanor conviction for child pornography. So it's not a hands-on offense. There's no violence involved. It's still breaking the law, I understand. And somebody who, who's been on the registry for quite some time. Yeah, I think that would be my perfect plaintiff. If you know anybody like that, let me know. Maybe it's you. Maybe it's not. Okay, so why does the IML cause so much trouble? The fact is that if you have, well, whether or not you have the unique identifier added to your passport, the fact is the federal government, the U.S. federal government, is going to send a notice to the country to which you are traveling. How would they even know that? Okay, if you're a covered offender under the IML, then you have to give 21-day notice, at least 21-day notice before you depart the country. So guess what? They know what flight you're taking. They know when you're departing. They know all this information about you, and they send it to the country to which you are traveling. Now, some people might think that the language is innocuous, but I don't think so. Okay, because it says something, and I'm paraphrasing here, folks. This is not verbatim. I'm paraphrasing. It says, this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. All right, so maybe some people think that's benign language, but I don't think that's benign language, because whoever is reading that language basically is interpreting it according to their own understanding and their own laws. When you use the term minor, in some countries, folks, the age of consent is 12. We're not talking about 18, we're talking about 12. That's, you know, so okay, so they're saying, ah, this person basically molested somebody who was under the age of 12. Okay, and then they go, it doesn't say how long you've been on the registry, how long ago that event occurred. It's not on there, right? So the person, again, who's receiving it is interpreting it with their own filters on and the only their own information about the laws in that country. And basically, they're afraid. They're afraid that you are going to pounce upon their children or their, you know, the women in their country, or maybe the men these days. So, folks, because of that, a lot of countries are, in fact, turning people away from even entering the country. And somebody here in the chat room said they were turned away from the state, country of Mexico. I'm not surprised, fortunately. So Mexico and Canada are neighbors, right? Mexico South, Canada North. And those two countries right now are, in general, not letting people enter the country. I mean, how ridiculous is that? I don't know about you, but I've gone to Seattle. I've driven across the border to go visit British Columbia. It's absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, I'm really glad that I went. But for person on the registry, it's telling them, no, we don't want you here. Now, I feel a little bit better about Canada because it's my understanding that Canada doesn't want anybody who's been convicted of any felony to go to Canada. Okay. Though there's a workaround there. And if you want to know the workaround, send me an email and I'll basically connect you with a Canadian attorney who might be able to help you gain entry into Canada if that's important. As far as Mexico, I don't know. Well, there's some stories. And so this is not legal advice. This is just a story. I've heard of people who have gone to San Diego and other places near the U.S.-Mexico border, who've walked across the border, who've taken a taxi across the border, different ways they get across the border. But remember that whole idea about giving people at least 21 days notice, not people, law enforcement, notice of at least 21 days before you leave this country and go visit another country. So here's, by the way, if anybody has a question about this, I really, somebody says Blue Shark Gardens. I do remember that. It was gorgeous. If you have a question or a comment, I'll put your hand up like Peter just did. All right. And then I'll talk about countries that allow registrants to visit. Peter, please, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, Jess. Good morning, Janice. Yes, you were stating right now that we can go into another country.
Yes.
Clarify this for me, because I even when you're on parole, because I'm on parole.
Well, you have, if you're on parole, you have to request permission to travel.
Right.
To, okay. But let's just say, but you know, you don't want to ask permission to go to Mexico or Canada right now because you're not going to get in. However, in Europe, there are 26 countries in Europe right now that allow people on the registry to come in. In fact, I think some of them just laugh at the Americans. I'm like, ah, you know, how stupid are those Americans, right? Because how do we're so uptight about sex. It's like, how do we procreate? So anyway, I digress. The fact is that the four large countries in Europe that allow registrants to visit are Italy, and I am of Italian descent, and I pat Italy on the back for being so smart, France, Germany, and Spain. So those are the four large European countries where you can go visit, and then there's 22 smaller ones. We have the list of countries on our website, but if you send me an email, I will go ahead and send it out to you.
Okay, thank you, Janice. And can you put your email in the chat or
it's already there.
It's already there. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, because I have some other questions that there was going to be a conference in San Diego, and that's close. I'm in that county. I'm in Imperial County, so San Diego would be closer to me to attend an actual conference.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
All right, you're certainly welcome. We have two more hands up. This next one, the phone number ends in 190. Would you please unmute yourself?
Hi.
Hi.
This is Bruce.
Hi,
in
Bruce.
Orlando, in Orlando, Florida. And I'm part of the Florida Act Committee, so I just wanted to point out my existence to not just you, Janice, who I met also at the ACTSOL conference. I'm the travel guy.
Oh, yes.
But I wanted to let Chris and Danielle know I'm here in case they're still on the phone. There is one thing I wanted to clarify about what you said about domestic travel.
Sure.
You actually mentioned Rhode Island. It still happens that I have a brother who I'm very close to in Rhode Island. I travel to Rhode Island pretty frequently, but I always follow your advice, which is, you know, they don't want me to be at their house forever. So I just go to Rhode Island, visit them for a few hours, go out to lunch or dinner or something, and then I leave. The other clarification I wanted to say is you talked about states that have 48 hours.
Yes.
Nevada, the law expresses it as 48 hours. Florida, the law expresses it in days and partial days count, including
in
at
Florida.
The present time, the day of your arrival will count. So unlike what you were saying about California, where you indicated that your day of arrival doesn't count and they don't start counting the days until the next day, that is not the case in Florida.
Bruce, please.
Yes.
Please don't say something that I didn't say. I didn't say in the state of Florida, the day you arrive doesn't count. I said that was true for the state of California. I was specifically answering a question about California. So please, let's be precise with our language. Thank you.
Okay, you said Florida was 48 hours. That's what you said.
Okay, well then I'm wrong. It's 2 days.
Okay.
It's what you said. Okay, let's go ahead to Michael. Michael, let's call on you next. Michael from Maine.
Hi, Janice.
Hi.
My question is, I'm not on the registry in Maine, and they said if I leave the state, I'll have to register.
So are you visiting Maine right now? You're not.
No, I live here. I live here. And so I was convicted a long time ago, 31 years ago, and they never put me on a registry when I got out of jail. And 15 years later, they put me on a registry, and I was on it for 3 years. And then I guess a law changed or someone went to court and fought I don't know what it was about, but I was able to petition to get off the registry. They put me on life and I was able to get off the registry. So I did and I got off, and I've been off the registry for a good over 10 years now. But, you know, I don't have to register in the state of Maine, but if I leave the state of Maine, I'm going to have to, I don't have to give them a 21 day notice if I leave, but if I go into another state, I got to comply with whatever the state does, you know, whatever state I go to.
Okay, well, that's an interesting life experience you've had, Michael. I'm glad that you haven't had to register in Maine. And I think you have tripped over the fact that even though you're not required to register possibly in a state even of conviction, you might have to register if you visited another state. So let's leave it at that. And Jay has his hand up. So Jay, if you go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hi, Janice. Jay from Orange County, California. Firstly, I want to thank you for everything you do for the registrant community. I'm from California, but I lived in Florida. That's where my offense originated. And I want to know, I'm currently tier one in the process of getting that hopefully squared away here soon. But I want to know, should that be successful, will I still be on the international Megan's Law because of Florida's system? I haven't lived there in 20 years, but they still keep me on. I was asking if there would be a way to get me off of that, but would I still be subject to the international Megan's Law if they don't take me off of that?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes. As long as you're required to register in any state, and that doesn't mean you're actively registering there, like Florida or New York, then the IML will still apply to you, even if you get off the California registry. So I made the offer earlier, and so for anybody, the fact is, if you send me an email, I will provide you with the name and contact information for an attorney in Florida who has, in fact, been able to get some people off the Florida registry, including one of my board members, by the way. I was able to get my board member off the California registry, and then he petitioned in Florida, and he was successful in Florida as well. But I'll tell you, he just maybe like you, Jay, he hasn't lived there for a couple of decades.
Okay. Thank you, Janice.
You're very welcome. All right. So there's a lot of chat information here in the chat room, which is great. Okay, but it's kind of hard for me to speak and read at the same time. So somebody said they don't see my email in the chat room. Let me add it here one more time, just so if you're listening to this and you know at a later time, because it is recorded, the meetings and stuff. My email address is J as in Janice, M as in Mary, Bellucci, easy to spell, B-E-L-L, like the word bell, and you add an Uchi on the end. U-C-C.
Thank you, Janice.
You're welcome. So it's jmbellucci at aol.com. And by the way, yes, I'm an AOL dinosaur. At least that's what my daughters call me. And I'm not changing my email address. So anyway.
Thank you so much, Janice. I got it now.
You're very welcome. So folks, let me tell you another ugly part of the International Megan's Law. Remember I mentioned earlier a unique identifier, also I call it a scarlet letter. The federal government has the right, because of the IML, to add a unique identifier to your passport. At the time of my lawsuit here in California, in federal district court, the fact is that the government attorney, part of her argument was, oh, well, this unique identifier is going to be an inconspicuous place in the passport. And originally it was in an inconspicuous place. It was for the back of the passport, one of the last pages on an endorsement page. That's no longer the case. Now the unique identifier, when they add it to your passport, is on page one of your passport. Listen to that. It's on page one of your passport. It's not on the cover, thank goodness. But the thing is that when somebody opens up your passport and looks inside, they will see on page one, the page facing your photograph and your passport number, they will have this quote unique identifier, which basically says, and I'm paraphrasing, it says this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. Remember what I said earlier about that language? It's ambiguous, it's vague. Who the heck knows what it really means? And whoever's reading it, of course, is going to interpret it the way that they interpret words like minor. Okay, so I'm not about you all. I'm mad as hell about this. That in fact the unique identifier is on the passport. So, but what happens if you don't have a unique identifier on your passport? This is something that could happen, and it happened to one of my clients, right? Is in fact he was on a flight to Europe. He was going to one of those 26 European nations where he would have been allowed to enter if only he had gone. But the problem was, okay, so he and his wife had a flight from Los Angeles, California to a European nation where he would have been allowed entry. They had boarded the flight, they had checked their luggage, and they were sitting there peacefully on their trip, on the plane rather, waiting to go overseas for a 3-week vacation. By the way, they were celebrating their 30th wedding anniversary. Well, as he was sitting there, he got a tap on the shoulder from a federal government official who happened to work for the Department of Homeland Security, and that government official said, get off the plane, you're not going anywhere, your passport has been revoked. And my client was shocked and dismayed to find this out, and said, what are you talking about, and showed him this DHS official, his passport. The DHS official took it from his hand and told him to get off the plane. Okay, so this is what happened to him. And he and his wife were not able to go to Europe. They'd spent a lot of money in advance buying, you know, for paying for places for them to stay for 3 weeks. And in fact, they were never allowed to go. And by the way, it was toward the end of the pandemic. It was really hard to get a passport. It takes longer to get a passport now than it used to. And there's no way he'd get a new passport passport within the 3-week period. So that is bad enough. But let me tell you what's even worse. And so this is like what might look like an ice cream sundae that's made out of fecal materials. Okay. And so the cherry on this fecal sundae is the fact that if the federal government hasn't already added a unique identifier to your passport, when you apply for a new passport, you have to specifically request that they add the unique identifier to your passport. I mean, I'm sorry, but that seems to me so crazy. I don't know. And I'm not trying to diminish what Jews experience in Nazi Germany, but to me, it's like if you were a Jew in Nazi Germany and you said, oh yeah, why don't you put that big red J on my passport? And by the way, at one point in time, of course, in Nazi Germany, they wouldn't let anybody who had the red J on their passport to leave the country. I'm not saying that's happening in the United States. Thank goodness it hasn't happened. But the fact is, I don't believe in the unique identifier. I think it is a scarlet letter. And there's no freaking way that I think anybody who's a resident, a citizen of the United States, should have that on their passport. So anyway, if I sound like a broken record in a commercial, I'm not going to apologize. It's terrible. And again, as I said, I want to sue the federal government again about the international Megan's Law. So if you know somebody who meets my criteria of a perfect plaintiff, please let me know. Okay, before I stop talking about travel, if you have a question, would you please raise your hand right now? Let's talk about it. It's harder for me to read a question that's in the chat room. If somebody else is reading a question about travel in the chat room, let me know. Okay, Michael, you got your hand up. Please unmute yourself.
Just one question. What's happening with SORNA regulations?
What's happening with SORNA regulations?
Yeah, the new SORNA regulations.
Okay. The new SORNA regulations are in effect in SORNA compliant states. So 18 out of 50 states are SORNA compliant. And I'm going to mute you, Michael, because there's some background noise there. But if you want to speak again, just let me know. In fact, I'll lower your hand so I'll know you want to speak again. So the SORNA regulations, again, are definitely effective and required in the SORNA compliant states. There are 18 of those states. I don't have the list in front of me, but if you go online, anybody, you can find out what the list is. So I don't know about Maine off the top of my head. I know California is not a SORNA compliant state. And so I think hell will freeze over before we become a SORNA compliant state. But the fact is, there's litigation that's pending about the question. And the question is, if you're not a SORNA compliant state, do the SORNA regulations apply to you? We don't know. I wish I could say with certainty, yes or no. I can't speak with certainty about this because this case is pending. And that is the main issue without an E on the end of it. Okay. So the fact is that we don't know if somebody who doesn't live in a SORNA compliant state has to comply with these latest regulations. By the way, you know what? These SORNA regulations are absolutely terrible. And if they ever applied in the state of California, I tell you what, our local law enforcement offices would be in a world of hurt. And what I mean by that is the SORNA regulations require a lot of people to register four times a year. And in California, our registrants only mostly register once a year. There's a very small group of people who are transient who have to register every 30 days. There's another group that has to register twice a year, but that's the exception, not the rule. So I can't imagine what would happen if somebody, and actually some people have tried in California, gone to their registration office, right? And you're like, okay, well, if I'm supposed to register every four times a year, I'm going to, 3 months later, go in to register again. And the registration officer basically threw them out of the office and said, we don't do that in California. So I'm sorry to say that a lot of hands went up on that one. Okay. I'm sorry to say that, that we don't know the answer again about people who don't live in this state. By the way, this pending lawsuit is being funded not by Axol, but by an organization called Pacific Legal Foundation. They're a great organization. They have a heck of a lot more resources than we do, including the fact that they've taken, I believe, at least 17 cases to the U.S. Supreme Court. Okay. And the U.S. Supreme, they've won 14 of the 17. That's a great track record. Okay. We have taken zero to the U.S. Supreme Court, though I'm just chomping at the bit to take a case up to the U.S. Supreme Court if they'll review it. But anyway, that's where we are, right? Okay. So Ben, you have your hand up. Would you unmute yourself, Ben?
Yeah. Hi. My question is about the name change laws in California. I'm from Florida, moved to California almost 20 years ago. And since I can't get off of that Florida website, I have a unique name. I wanted to change my name so that anytime somebody ever looked me up, that's not the first thing that pops up. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just get my name changed. It might be a workaround to help me a bit. And as it turns out in California, if you are trying to change your name, if you have a criminal record or specifically the language says trying to avoid or evade the registry, that you can't get a name change. So if I get myself removed from the registry because I'm a level one, will I then be able to get my name changed without a problem in the state of California?
You know what, Ben? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it offline during a meeting that's not being recorded. And I'm not being flippant about it at all. I think in California, if you do change your name, you're still on the registry, you have to let people know it's an alias. So, but I'm not completely sure about that. So if you would contact me during the week next week, okay?
Okay. Yeah. And just to be clear, I am eligible to be removed from the registry, but I just haven't done that because I'm on probation for a misdemeanor traffic offense. And until I'm off of that traffic misdemeanor probation, I can't do it. But once I am, I'll be eligible. I'll be removed from it as a level one. So it's
okay. Yeah. And so Ben, you've stated something that is true and also important. And we're going to talk a little bit later about the tiered registry law, eligibility, the petitioning process, et cetera. But the fact is, you're right. If you're on parole or probation in California, you are not, you cannot yet apply or petition for removal from the registry. So thank you for bringing it up. Connie, you have your hand up. Please unmute yourself.
Okay. I have to leave, but I re-met years ago, like before the pandemic, at a conference in Sacramento. And it's my son that I'm here for. And I'd like to talk to you more, but I have to go. So would it be okay if I contact you?
Yes.
And just you and I talk?
Absolutely. Folks, that's why I put my email address in the chat box here, the chat room. Okay. And so please feel free to give me send me an email. I'd rather go ahead and set a meeting date and time with for a phone meeting or a Zoom meeting like this. Because the thing is, if you just call me out of the blue, I may be on a call with somebody else, on a meeting with somebody else, or I might be in court. It's just better for all of us if, in fact, you go ahead and set up an appointment with me. So thank you, Connie.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Tom A., your hand is up, sir. Would you please unmute yourself?
Yeah. Hi, all. I have a question. If you were to put in a move request, a move notification from the state that you're living in, and the move notification was to a foreign country, would you ever need to have any type of interaction again with the registry?
Yes, possibly. And I'll tell you why. The international migrants law, as bad as it was to begin with, is even worse now. And what I mean by that, now they're saying that as long as you're a U.S. citizen, if you're living outside of the country, you're still on the registry. If you're required to register in any state, then you're still on the registry. So that's the bad news. I'm sorry, folks. I wish it weren't true.
Is there any link that I could get to that I could read about that?
If you would, again, send me an email and I'd be happy to send a link about it.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care.
You too. By the way, this is one of the things about the registry, and one reason it's so terrible, just every state registry in general is so terrible, is because the legislatures and legislators in every state keep thinking about what can we do next, right? And I think for some of the people that they really don't care one way or the other, but they think that if they basically introduce a law and get it passed, by the way, even better for them, they think, then that's going to help them get reelected. So at some point in time, you know, again, it's not something that necessarily people and legislators care about, but they think, again, if they pass this law that's tough on people on the registry, that's going to help them get reelected. And by the way, it was that way for a long time, because for a long time, there was nothing negative that would happen to a legislator or law if it got passed, right? But things have changed. So Axol, we've been in existence now for 12 years. We've filed more than 100 lawsuits in the state of California. It's not perfect in California, but I'll tell you what, life for a registrant is better in California than in most states. So Ellie, if you're still you online, could I ask you for a big favor, which is that you could talk about something while I make a quick bathroom break? I'd appreciate it greatly.
Certain. Okay. One thing that I was dealing with the chat is there's some individuals here online in this meeting who have been convicted of a 288 and they're on 20-year parole. And I was researching the law earlier, and it's very specific that it has to be a Penal Code Section 288, Subdivision B, Subdivision 1. And that's in Penal Code Section 3000, Subdivision B, Subdivision 4, Subdivision A, and it's only the 288 B1s. And so I'm not certain who's on parole here, but those of you who are, should reach out to me after the meeting, because I'm going to contact a parole attorney. Parole isn't my area of expertise, but I'm a little concerned that people are on 20-year parole and maybe their conviction isn't in the statute. And I don't know if people file a 602 first in California, that's a complaint, but I will look into that further for any individual who's subject to 20-year parole. I also have a client who his sex offense happened when he was a minor, and then he picked up a subsequent offense as an adult that carried a life sentence. He's out on parole. He has to take Sharper Future, and he's just had one nightmare after another with Sharper Future because there's a turnover with the counselors, and so he tries to get out of taking Sharper Future classes, and there's a new counselor and they say, I don't have your information. And so he's been on this revolving door in Sharper Future. And I know Janice has a case pending in regard to those parole conditions, but there's just a lot of people having issues with Sharper Future.
So Ellie, what you're describing is common, unfortunately, way too common. So in California, if you're on parole for sure, and if you're on probation, maybe you have to go through treatment. That's what they call it, treatment. Okay. And the question is, how long do you have to go through treatment? And it could be counseling, it could be group counseling, it could be individual counseling. And unfortunately, with some of the treatment providers, it seems like they're checking boxes. So what they're doing is really not helping people rehabilitate, but instead it's just checking a box. Sometimes I've been told that they come in and they're shown a movie that has absolutely no relevance to rehabilitation. So because of this, we do have a lawsuit pending in California. In fact, we have a trial on June 14th. So this lawsuit basically is calling to the judge's attention the fact, again, in the state of California, we're talking about, there is a law that says that the minimum amount of time in treatment is 1 year. 1 year, not 7 years, certainly not 20 years, it's 1 year. And then the other two parts of the same law say, then after the first year, the Department of Corrections is supposed to talk to the treatment providers and ask in a formal way, not just on a phone call or an email, does this person need to continue treatment? And there's supposed to be this conversation between. Okay? And then the third provision is, and a judge can terminate treatment at any time after that first year. So I was successful in a case up here in Northern California for a gentleman who had been in treatment for over 5 years. He'd been told by his treatment provider that he, in fact, completed treatment. And he thought, that's great. And they told him, basically, go away. You don't have to go to treatment anymore, individual or group. But then what happened is CDCR, Department of Corrections, entered into a contract with a different company. And maybe this is something similar, Ellie, to what you were describing, and maybe different. But the fact is, the new company said, oh, well, we don't trust the other company what they did, so we're going to make you go back into treatment, and by the way, you have to start all over again. Now, this is somebody who had no violations, he had a stable marriage, he had stable housing, he had a full-time employment, and in fact, that was the reason he wanted to stop the treatment, was that he had a very demanding job, and the treatment was really, it was, not only was it not necessary, it was also impeding his employment opportunities. So the judge in Santa Clara County was very good. She had a stiff backbone and she stopped it. She said, no, that's enough. He's gone through enough treatment. Look, here's a certificate that says his treatment is completed. What the heck are you guys doing, right? And it was a really interesting situation during this hearing, because I thought it was going to, I was going to have to use my best lawyerly abilities to drag it out of CDCR that they were requiring people to continue treatment forever. And you know what? Lo and behold, maybe it was my abilities as a lawyer, and maybe it was just dumb luck. But whatever it was, that both of the CDCR employees who testified during that hearing said, oh, yeah, we have a policy in the state of California that a registrant on parole must continue treatment the entire time they're on parole. And folks, that was inconsistent with state law. In other words, in my argument, legal argument was that the Department of Corrections was actually violating state law by doing exactly that. And so that one judge agreed with me. But the case that's pending now in Los Angeles County is a broader lawsuit. And if the judge gives us the ruling that we want, it will affect everybody in the state of California. So it's going to require CDCR to do a lot more work. And I'm sure they don't want to do that work, but that's just too bad. The state says they have to do it. And I see a comment in the chat room, which I agree with completely, that these companies exist to make money. I'm sure you mean the treatment providers, and I absolutely agree. So it's really the foxes guarding the hen house here, folks. So the people who are making money out of you having continued treatment are being asked, do you need more treatment? Well, what do you think they're going to say? So anyway, and by the way, I don't think that everybody is going to benefit from this ruling that I'm expecting. I'm expecting a positive decision from the judge because he seems to be leaning in our direction. I guess he could always surprise me. But the fact is, if you have violated parole several times, if you've done all kinds of other things, you know, you're not going to be in the same category as the person in Santa Clara County. So but it had to be challenged because we in California, I believe we have over 7,000 registrants on parole right now. 7,000 registrants. That's a whole lot of people who are basically being required to not just to complete treatment the first time, but continue the treatment on and on in perpetuity. So let's talk about, I guess it's time to talk about the tiered registry law. Oh, got a hand up first. So Peter, please unmute yourself. You have a question or a comment?
Yes, just a question. Janice, do you know anything about plea bargains? Because I pleaded to a 4-year term of parole and they switched it when I got out and now it's 10 years.
You know what, I think Ellie might be better suited to answer that, but
okay. Yeah, I have her email. She put it in the chat. So thank you, Janice, though.
Sure, but Ellie, why don't you go ahead and answer that question? Because I think there are a lot of people out there.
I'm not a parole expert, but I can research the law. And that's what I was doing in regard to the 20-year, 6-month parole. It's very specific. And I'd have to know more about your facts, Peter,
before okay, I can address yes.
them. So email me after the meeting.
Yes, I will. Thank you so much, Ellie.
Okay, you're welcome.
So folks, I know a little bit about parole's situation too. It's frustrating and it's sad. By the way, the prison law office, if you go online, they have a great publication about this, about parole and people, you know, on the registry on parole. And I've talked to so many people that have had a similar experience to what Peter was just talking about. And what we're discussing is that when you entered into a plea agreement, you thought you had X number of years on parole, only to find out after you're released from custody that the number is much larger. So there's all kinds of things that could affect that. One of the things, I'll just go ahead and say it, it's this U.S. Supreme Court decision that has affected so many people's lives in a very significant and adverse way. That decision was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court 21 years ago, and it's called Smith versus Doe, which is a really boring name, but please remember it. Okay, so Smith versus Doe basically gives government at every level, whether it's city, county, state, and the federal government, the right to pass new laws and apply them retroactively. That's why that decision has to be overturned. That's the decision that if I ever get to the U.S. Supreme Court, I hope it's on that issue, because it was a stupid, ridiculous, and I could use a lot more adjectives that use four-letter words, so we'll just leave it at that, stupid and ridiculous decision that was made by a court based on an article from Psychology Today magazine. So anyway, Smith versus Doe must go. And so Danielle was talking about earlier, and Chris was there too. We were in Washington, D.C., gosh, it's almost exactly a year ago, basically on the steps of the Supreme Court, or at least as close to the steps as they would allow us to be. And I personally challenged, I was one of the speakers there, and I personally challenged the U.S. Supreme Court to to basically fix its mistake. So there are U.S. Supreme Court cases that have been overturned. You might have heard of Brown versus Board of Education. So sometimes they make stupid decisions and later they overturn themselves. That needs to happen in Smith versus Doe. So I will just leave it there. Okay. Somebody asked in the chat room, have you ever heard about anyone who is off the registry who is traveling internationally still having a notice sent to the country they are traveling to? The answer is no, I've not heard of that. Having said that, when my clients get off the registry, one of the services that I offer to them is to send a notice to the Department of Homeland Security saying this person is no longer required to register in the state of California. Okay. And so when I do that, I get a reply. And the reply says three things. Thing number one, that this person no longer has to give a 21-day notice. I say, duh, of course not. They're no longer required to register. Number two, they are no longer required to have a unique identifier. Again, duh. Okay. But the third thing, so those two are very positive. The third thing, though, I find troubling because it says, oh, and we still reserve the right to send a notice to the country to which they're traveling. Like, huh. I mean, doesn't that make you wonder? How do they know you're traveling to a country overseas, right? If you haven't given them a 21-day notice. And the only thing that I can figure out is, in fact, they, the federal government, are combing the manifest of every single flight that takes off from the United States to a foreign country. And if they find somebody on that manifest who even used to be able to required to register, right, that, in fact, they're going to notify the country to which you're traveling. I hope that's not the case. I hope our federal government has more important things to do than that, but I'm not sure. And so that's, I think, where we are in there. But I will tell you, that's one more reason that the SORNA, the pending lawsuit about the SORNA regulations, is so darn important, because it's asking whether or not a person even who's no longer required to register, if the SORNA regulations can apply to that person. Well, the answer to that question might in fact also apply to the international Megan's Law. We shall see. And by the way, the Pacific Legal Foundation is willing and ready to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in this case about the SORNA regulation. They have resources we don't. They have 50 attorneys on staff. I'm so jealous. Maybe someday AXA will have 50 attorneys, but we don't yet. We have one attorney, me, and I have a litigation assistant, yes, and we do have a total of 5 attorneys, including Ellie, who are on the board of directors, and so we do have a deep bench that way, but that's not the same as being able to litigate. Okay, so Hiker Mark, you agree with me that Smith versus Doe is a horrible decision? Thank you for that. Okay. All right. So let's talk about the tiered registry law. And I know we have people here from all over the country, and that's fabulous and fantastic. AXAL is a national organization, and so we're happy to provide everybody in our country with information. Okay. And I even think that people who live in other states might find interesting, if not informative, about the tiered registry law in California and what is and isn't happening. Okay. So after only 7 years of lobbying for a tiered registry law, and that is sarcasm, folks, because it took us a long time to get a tiered registry law passed. And then the final tiered registry law is not what we asked for. So this happens often in legislation. It's not just because it's us. It's not just because of the subject matter, but often the bill that gets introduced may or may not resemble the final product. So we got some of what we asked, but we certainly didn't get everything that we asked. So in the year 2017, the tiered registry law was passed by the California legislature, and then it became effective only 3 years later. That's more sarcasm. Why in the heck did it take them 3 years? Oh, well, that's because the California Department of Justice convinced the legislature it was going to take them that long to get ready for it. And then they're still doing a miserable job. So it's getting slightly better than in the beginning when they were doing a terrible instead of just a miserable job. Okay. So under the tiered registry law, everybody in the state of California who's been convicted of a sex offense is supposed to be assigned to a tier, T-I-E-R, okay, tier. Tier one, minimum requirement to register is 10 years. Tier two, minimum requirement time is 20 years. And tier three, unfortunately, for almost everybody assigned to tier three, you're stuck there for lifetime for now. Okay, I'm talking about what does the law currently say? That's what it said. The petitioning process began on July 1 of the year 2021. So we've had about 2.5 years worth. And I'll tell you, in 2.5 years, I have helped 96 people get off the registry. So 96 of my clients are no longer required to register in the state of California. I consider that remarkable. Before the tiered registry law, I did certificates of rehabilitation, which at that point in time was the only way to get off the registry. And quite frankly, very few people were eligible to submit an application for a certificate of rehabilitation. The clients that I had were granted, you know, their certificates were granted and they got off the registry, but very few people were eligible. So the fairly vast improvement here, tiered registry laws compared to certificates of rehabilitation, that now about 45% of the people on the registry are eligible to petition for removal after they do their 10 or 20 years. Okay. That's 45%. To me, that's not enough people. That's less than half. Okay. So we as an organization are working really hard to increase the number. But still in California, we have over 100,000 people on the registry. That means 45,000 people are eligible to petition at some point in time. Okay, so let's talk about the petitioning process, which the petitioning process is a person can file their own petition. There is an instruction for doing it. So this form is CR-415. That's petition form. It's all these forms, by the way, are available on the AXOL website. Or if you send me an email, I will send them to you in an email. Okay. And there's even an instruction for CR-415 instruction. Some people are not comfortable doing it. If you're not comfortable doing that, you can go to your public defender's office if you're comfortable with public defenders. And I know some people are not because you may or not been treated well by a public defender. Okay. But the fact is they can do it. The other option is go to ELLI, if you're low income or no income, and the Loyola Law School can do it for free. Okay. If you contact me, I'm not going to do it for free. I'll just tell you bluntly, but I will also tell you that my rate is low as compared to most other lawyers. So I'm bound and determined to get as many people off the registry as possible. I thought I was aiming high at the beginning with thinking 100 people I would get off the registry. My goal is a lot higher than that now, maybe 1,000 before I'm finished. Well, we shall see, but at least get to 200, that's for sure. Okay, so I have gotten 96 people off the registry so far. I have filed about 130 petitions. And the only reason that number is different is because it takes a while to get through the process. Okay, so after you fill the petition form, the CR-415, the next step is you have to get that petition confirmed by the court. And that's a fancy way of saying you get a date timestamp on that. And if they're going to schedule a hearing right away, and I'll talk about that in a minute, they'll put a hearing date on that as well. It's a confirmed copy of the petition that you must serve both on the district attorney in the county where you currently reside. Listen to that. Where you currently reside. Not where you were convicted, but the county where you currently reside. Okay. Also upon the local law enforcement office. That means where you register. So you send confirmed copies and you don't have to take them in person. You can mail them. Okay. You can, in fact, do those two things. And then, there's one thing I forgot to say. When you file the petition, there's a form that must accompany the petition or the court will basically reject the petition. Okay. Not deny it, but reject it. And there's a big difference there. So that form is called the proof of current registration, which is not the same as your annual registration, okay? Annual registration form is 6 pages long, okay? And the proof of current registration form is only 2 pages long. The California Department of Justice created the proof of current registration form just for the purpose of the tiered registry law, and it must accompany the petition or the court will reject the petition. All right, so let's just say you were successfully completed the petition, you filed the petition with the court, you sent a confirmed copies of the petition to the county DA where you live and to the registration office. By the way, if you were indeed convicted in another county, then you also need to send confirmed copies of the petition to the DA in that county and also where you registered in that county. So it starts getting a little cumbersome, but most people can do it if you wish to, if you don't have PTSD or something else. Okay, so, all right. So then what happens next is you basically can be waiting up to 4 months and hear nothing. And I hear from my clients a lot during the four-month period. It's like a kid going on a car trip with parents. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And I have to keep having to say, no, we're not there yet. Because what happens is, according to the tiered registry law, your law enforcement office where you register has up to 60 days to decide whether or not you're eligible. So what they're going to do is pull up your criminal rap sheet and look and see, what was this person convicted of? When were they convicted? When were they released from custody? Blah, 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 blah. And do you have any pending criminal charges? Okay. Also, do you have any failures to register? If you have a failure to register, it doesn't mean that you can't petition. It just means you have to wait long. Okay. And I'm not going to mention any numbers here because that can get confusing. But anyway, you're still eligible to petition, but you'll have to wait a longer period of time. Okay. So, and then after the law enforcement makes a decision about whether or not you are eligible, then they send that over to the DA's office, okay? And the DA decides whether or not to object to your petition. So whether or not you object to your petition is huge. That's the big decision, okay? If the DA does not object to your petition, there's a 99% chance the court's going to grant it. I'm not going to say 100% because I can't guarantee anything, or they'll take my bar license away. So anyway, it's very likely that the court will grant your petition if the DA does not object to your petition. By the way, DAs are more reluctant, therefore less likely to object to your petition after 3 recent court decisions, which I'll mention in a few minutes. Okay, so if the DA does object to your petition, there will be a hearing, okay? The hearing will not be, there won't be any live testimony taken. It's basically based on written record. In a very few instances, the victim was able to add a victim impact statement. But I will tell you what, in the 2 cases where that happened, 2 my cases where that happened, it didn't make any difference if the judge granted the petition anyway. Okay. In both of those cases, it was over 25 years ago, the conviction of offense. So in the court, then the ultimate decision about your petition is made by a judge. It's not the DA, thank goodness, right? But in fact, a judge is going to make a decision. And if you've been found eligible by the registration office and the DA has not objected to your petition, I would say there's a 99% chance that your petition is going to be granted. And that is wonderful. That means you'll never have to register again in the state of California unless, in fact, you're convicted of another sex offense. So it's a huge relief in the state of California. And for anybody who's my client and they get a court order granting the petition, I immediately send it to California Department of Justice, say, get this person off the registry, get this person's profile off the Megan Saw website. Okay. Eventually it would happen, but the courts are supposed to send this information to California DOJ, and sometimes the courts are really, takes them a long time to do that. I don't think there's any malice there. I just think they have more important things to do, but you and I know better. There's nothing more important, right, than getting you off the registry. Okay. So if anybody has a question about the tiered registry law, about the process, anything like that, this is a good time to put your hand up. I have a few more things to say about it. Ellie, I'm going to invite you to say what you want to say about it as well. But let me just talk briefly about three really important cases, okay? So they're called People versus Ty, People versus Franco, and People versus Fragoso. All 3 of those decisions, their appellate court decisions, said virtually the same thing, which is the district attorney has the burden to prove that you are a current danger to society. I'll tell you what, when the first decision came out, it was music to my ears. And when the second and third decisions came out saying virtually the same thing, it was almost like the Hallelujah Choir. Hallelujah Chorus. So it's very clear in California law now that the district attorney must prove that you pose a current danger. Because before that, the DAs kept saying that it was a burden of the registrant to prove that he or she does not pose a current danger. And folks, it's so hard to prove a negative like that. It really is. So this clarification from the appellate courts is worth its weight in gold, literally. And by the way, the third of those 3 decisions was my case, And it's the only petition I have filed that's been denied. And I want to tell you, it was a horror scene that day in that case. And what I mean by that is the judge in that case forgot that day that he was a judge. And, you know, like many judges, Superior Court judges anyway, they are former deputy district attorneys before they become judges. And that day he acted like he was still a deputy DA. And so I was so angry. My client was humiliated because the judge, again, he testified as if he were the deputy DA. He argued, the judge argued as if he were the deputy DA. But that judge, in that day, in that court, I walked out and it was for the first of those three decisions, I said, nope, I am not going to let this judge do this to my client, and I'm going to appeal it. And thank goodness between then and the time that I filed the appeal of my own, we had one decision, People versus Ty, then People versus Franco came out, and then this is the third decision. Sometimes, folks, you have to educate judges, okay? Just because they're judged doesn't mean they're always right. Have you noticed that about judges? They're people, too. And so the fact is that we need to educate them. So, all right, so here we go. Somebody said, I missed those court cases, are they California only? The answer is yes. Okay. Oh, Ellie, you'd answer that too. I thought somebody else. Do you have to attend the hearing or is it administrative? Yes, you have to attend the hearing if there's a hearing about your petition. But the fact is, when my clients go with me to court, they say nothing. They're there. And, you know, I've stayed on the record and the defendant is present in the court today and they don't say anything. Okay. One judge basically saw that, you know, three family members were in the courtroom with the person on that day and was very kind and asked the family members if they wanted to say anything in support of their loved one, and they did. Okay. But that is only, and all the times I've gone to court, that's the only time it's happened. And by the way, here are a few more statistics remember I filed over 130 petitions so far. Only about 10% of them has a DA objected to. And I'm going to watch that percentage. I'm going to have to, I think, adjust it, because I think after the Fragoso decision, this third one, I think they're going to be fewer DAs objecting to petitions. Because they know that they're going to, you know, the chance that they're going to lose, they can't meet that burden of proof. And I'll tell you one of the reasons why. In one of my cases, and by the way, it involved a woman on the registry, the DA asked the judge to order probation to basically give her an evaluation, a psychological evaluation. I objected to that. But guess what? The great thing is the judge issued the order and the probation department said, no, we're not going to do a psych eval. This person, she's not on probation. By the way, she hadn't been on probation for 30 freaking years, right? And so at that point in time, the probation office did what needed to be done and said no. And so that was a good thing. So the fact is, folks, if you're not on parole and not on probation, they can't make you undergo a psychological evaluation. Now, I will tell you this, that if one of my clients gets an objection from a district attorney, then I'm going to recommend that my client get a psychological evaluation done and that you pay for it. And this is the reason why. If the results are not in your favor, they don't ever have to be mentioned, okay? They don't have to be mentioned. And what we're looking for in a psych eval, by the way, is in fact something that says that you're a low risk or a very low risk of reoffense. And by the way, every single psych eval I've seen has said low risk or very low risk of reoffense. I'm looking about international travel. I'm not going to go back to that topic. So the tiered registry law, we as an organization are continuing to request that it be improved. Okay. As I said, the law we asked for is not the law that we got. It's better than nothing. So it's easier to build on something than to start from nothing. So we are going to be in Sacramento in our state capitol on March 6th of this year. We're going in to request that these improvements be made to the tiered registry law. By the way, the Sex Offender Management Board is supporting some of those proposals, not as many as we'd like, but at least some of them. And we will continue this until we get the tiered registry law we want, or, oh, here's an even better idea. Let's get rid of the registry altogether. So, Sean, I see your hand up. Did you have a question?
Yeah. You didn't talk about the static 99, which is part of the tiered registry.
it tells you, you know, what tier you're going to be on. And it's the thing that I have the biggest complaints with. A little bit about me is I'm currently tier 2. So that's, I have to register for 20 years. And I'm, the reason I'm on that tier is by a single point. On the Static 99, I had 4 points instead of 3. And all those points, I think, are, for those who don't know the Static 99, I got a point because my victim was a stranger. If I knew my victim, I would only have to register for 10 years. I got a point because of my age. I was 22 at the time. I got a point because I hadn't known my victim for more than 24 hours. I knew her for 22 hours. And then I also got a point because I had never lived with a love someone for over 2 years, with a like a girlfriend for more than 2 years. I was 21 at the time. So of course I hadn't lived with a loved one for more than 2 years. And because all those 4 points, now I have to register for 20 years instead of 10. The whole thing is going to be more punitive than if I, you know, it's going to be like 25, 26 years from the start of the case to when I'm totally off. And that's just something I want to bring up, you know, when we go, I'm going to be there March 6th. But I think that's another thing that I don't agree with is the whole Static 99 is so cut and dry. So, yeah.
Well, Sean, I hope that you'll contact me privately because I'm not sure if there might be an exception for you. So in other words, I know there are people like if people are assigned to tier 3 solely because of their Static 99 score, there's an exception where they can petition after 10 years. So I don't know if there's an exception for you. So I mean, after 20 years. Okay, people assigned to tier 3, if the only reason you're on tier 3 is because of a high Static 99 score, you can then petition after 20 years. I don't know about your situation, but I'm really intellectually curious about this, and I'd be happy to look it up for you.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll see you in a couple weeks, and then I'll also probably contact you before then. But yeah, something I'm passionate about. So I also, okay. I've called you before. I work with COSA. I was the one who works with COSA. Okay.
Well, why don't you go ahead and talk about COSA a little bit, because you guys are doing such wonderful work there.
Yeah. So COSA, right now, we're based out of, it was originally Sacramento, and then they've opened a new chapter in San Diego. And basically, it's just a group to help those who've recently got out of prison or are struggling kind of with all the rules and regulations that are put upon you being a sex offender. And we have a group weekly. And then also we have a lot of different ways we can help those people in our organization kind of get what they need as far as housing. We can pay first month's rent. We pay any automobile. Like if something happens to your car, we can help with some reimbursements. Basically, we know how hard it is when you first get out to kind of reacclimate to society. And we kind of help ease that process with a bunch of different things. And we're always looking for new ways. We got a pretty large grant. And so we're always looking for new ways that money could go to really help the pain points of reacclimating to society. And it's gone very well. And we have a good success going. And we're getting new people in the program all the time. And what we're finding is we originally were going after those who have recently got out of prison. But there's more people out there that are struggling and could need help. So now we're kind of expanding that to just anyone who is maybe struggle finding employment. That's one thing I've really focused on is creating resumes for sex offenders, because when you get out, your resume is not going to look great, but there's a lot of things you can do, a lot of ways you can make your resume look better. And a resume really goes a long way when getting a job these days. And so that's kind of, yeah. So I highly recommend if anyone's in San Diego or in Sacramento, look into COSA, COSA, and maybe I could help you in the future. So, yeah.
Thank you, Sean. Is there something you could add in the chat part of this meeting? Maybe some way people can connect with COSA?
Yeah. I'll put our website and then I'll link the person's number that I work with. But yeah, so okay. Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome. So Sean did bring up something really important about Static 99. By the way, Static 99 has been around for so many years. It was developed by a man in Canada, Scott I'll remember his name in a minute. But the fact is that it's not perfect. Okay. And in fact, it's very biased against young people and against gay people. So if you're young and gay, you're going to have at least 4 points. Sean said he's a heterosexual, so I'm not questioning that, but I'm just saying if a young person is gay and young underneath 25 years old, you're automatically going to be considered a score of four or higher. And that means you're high risk. And that means you have an even steeper mountain to climb, including when it comes to tier assignments, because you could end up in tier 3 lifetime registration simply because you have a quote high static 99 score. So it's not fair. A lot of this isn't fair. I hope you all have noticed it's not fair. And that's why Ellie and I are working so diligently to help you all basically make it through the day. I sometimes talk about landmines because it does seem like that. And if you step on one of these landmines, you could be blown up one way or the other. I think the thing I worry about the most is people being returned to custody. Okay. So Ellie, I think this is toward the end of our meeting. And so if there's something you want to say in I guess concluding our meeting, I'll also give the final farewell, but you have the floor now.
Thank you. In regard to those who want to travel internationally, I did find a website, Travel Matrix, but I couldn't open up the entire list, and I'm not that computer literate to search for the entire list, but it's apparently a list of countries who will accept a registrant in that country. And the other thing is, if you have a specific country, you could always call the consulate. I'm in Los Angeles, and so there's a lot of consulate offices, and I'm sure they would have the answer.
Okay, thank you, Ellie. As you all can tell, we cover a broad range of topics in these meetings. And by the way, neither Ellie nor I ever give legal advice in these meetings, but we share legal information because there's some broad statements that we can make that are not specific to your situation. And that's too why Ellie and I provide you with our contact information so that you can have a private consultation with us when it's not being recorded. Okay. So as I've said before, we're repeating that these meetings are being recorded, and the very good reason that there are some people who are not available on Saturday mornings to be participating in the meetings or even listening to the meetings, but instead can listen to them or watch them at a later time. So in conclusion, I want to thank you again for joining us here for our meeting. The date is February 17th. And I want to say that the date of the next meeting here is in fact on March 16th. So on March 16th, I will be back. Perhaps Ellie will join us. And a lot of times we have another board member, Jeff Stein, who's also an attorney, who often joins us as well. So thank you very much. We really hope that we've been able to share some important information with you today. Bless you, and hope to see you next month. Bye-bye.